Insights, solutions, and networking all come together at RSA Conference. Join a global cybersecurity community at rsaconference.com/ITSPMAG24.
You're tuning into an episode of the Redefining Society podcast, hosted by Marco Cappelli. Let's face it, the future is now. We live in a hybrid analog digital society, and we must stop ignoring it or pretending that technology is not affecting us. The line between the physical and virtual worlds has become a figment of our imagination. On it, we are continually performing a dangerous balancing act, juggling convenience, privacy, freedom, security, technology, society, culture, and even the future of humanity. There is no better place than here, and no better time than now to muse on our relationship with technology and how to redefine what society means in this new age.
BugCrowd's award-winning platform combines actionable contextual intelligence with the skill and experience of the world's most elite hackers to help leading organizations identify and fix vulnerabilities, protect customers, and make the digitally connected world a safer place. Learn more at bugcrowd.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Redefining Society, where we talk about all the way that technology affect our life, in the good, in the bad. We often talk about social media. We often talk about artificial intelligence, generative AI. You have to. It's the law. You have to talk about that. And there is other things that we need to talk about when it comes down to society, because we live our life in a hybrid way. We are online in a digital world, but we also are in the real world. And yeah, what is the line there is really blurry. I think it's real. Everything we do online as well has certainly affect one another. So today, we're going to talk about something we use quite a bit, which is social media and the way that it gets into politics, it gets into privacy, it gets into our life. And oftentimes, lately, we hear a lot about this TikTok and how it is a political topic, maybe, and how we talk about privacy and sharing of data with some other country, and a lot of things that may sound a little bit confusing. So today we have Theresa Pathan with us. She is going to explain some of those things. And Theresa's been going out there talking about cybersecurity, working for the White House for a very long time. And we had a conversation or two in the past. I'm so happy to have you back.
Hey, thanks for welcoming back. And I can't wait to see how our conversation unfolds today.
Well, there is a lot of places we can go. And I think we could start with the beginning, which is the people that don't know about you. A little introduction about yourself. I know it would take the entire podcast, so maybe you can keep it short. And then we dive into the conversation.
So, no, absolutely. Thank you so much. And, you know, I would just say, just real briefly, I spent 16 years in the financial services industry, focusing on customer-centered designs and delivering technology platforms that a banking customer like you might want to use, Marco, but at the same time, making sure it supported the business units. And, oh, by the way, keep it secure from fraudsters. And we didn't even call them cyber criminals yet, just, I don't know, digital criminals. Had the honor and the opportunity to work for the United States as the first female chief information officer to ever hold, first female to hold that role. Worked for President George W. Bush from 2006 to 2008. And it was there that was really a tipping point for me as somebody who's always focused on the human user story and technology and enabling human user stories And when I saw the capabilities of the adversary, if you think about 2006 to 2008, the first ever iPhone was released in 2007. So just a tremendous time of kind of the consumerization of technology. And it was a tipping point for me realizing that security really didn't design from a human-centered design standpoint. Case in point, I have yet to meet somebody who's not in cybersecurity who loves strong passwords, Marco. Like the longer the better, the more complicated they have to be, and the fact that they can't look like any of the last 15 passwords that you had. I've never had somebody thank me for that. So I thought about that a lot, and I thought, I really would like to take an opportunity to take the training that the country had invested in me in helping me understand the tactics, techniques, and protocols that the adversary had, and use it to protect people and businesses and nations. And so kind of with the blessing of my family and the tremendous support of my family, founded Fortilis. And I've got two fantastic women executives who I actually met during my time at the White House, Bridget and Melissa. And we now focus on human-centered design and securing the digital transformation efforts of some of the world's largest companies, privately held and publicly traded, as well as individuals. We also like to do things like give back. And so we do pro bono training and fundraising and support for the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And that's just a little bit about us.
And then you find time for your personal life too, of course.
You have to be very focused and deliberate about making the right calls on your calendar. It's funny you say that, Marco, because I'll have people say to me, you know, how do you find work-life balance? And I often tell people, I would like to remove that phrase from conversation, because when you say work-life balance, it assumes that everybody else has it figured out and like you're the only loser who can't. And so what I want to tell people is life is perfectly imperfect, and that's okay. And what's balanced for somebody isn't balanced for somebody else. And balance will change daily. So I always say it's work-life choices and priorities. And you just have to have the right system for you to eyes wide open, look at your calendar, schedule things on your calendar, and then actually give yourself a performance review and ask yourself, are you skewed, you know, too much in one direction? And what are you going to do to course correct that? Just like you would in your work life. You know, you look at goals, you look at dates, you look at deadlines, you look at how much time you spend on a project. You have to do the same thing based on your priorities in your life.
Yeah, agree. It's all about balance and change and adapting to things. And this come up a lot in my podcast, because we talk about society and technology. I make the joke because it's called Redefining Society. And I said, you know, every time I redefine it, I have to start all over again because it keeps changing. So our topics, especially now with working from home, using technology, virtual apps, API, and all those kind of things that most of the time we don't need to know how they work in the background, but we use it. And sometimes maybe a little bit of knowledge, it can help doing these things and stay, you know, floating with the changes of life and with the changes in technology and the way we work. But also in the way we play, because today we're going to talk about app that entertain people. And many times they don't understand that in order to get stuff from it, we need to give stuff to it. And that's called data. And sometimes there may be a little too much. And what does too much means. So there was a research that you pointed out. And so let's talk about that. Let's dive in. What is that really got your attention out of this research?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, there was a great study. And if anybody wants to dig into the study after this podcast, it was done by Surfshark. And so if you're looking for it, you know, just look for their app privacy checker study. It was done December of 2023, so it's fairly current. And what I loved about this study was it really provides a little bit of context into the data collection practices of many of the popular mobile applications that we all know and love. I do have some people push back on me and say, well, I don't use social media, I'm not on it. But guess what? Your family members have probably texted you or emailed you a video that you love or a meme that you love and you think it's super funny. So guess what? Based on trackers, you are on social media, whether you know it or not. And so this is very interesting. When you look at the key findings of this study, and I think this is what's really important to cover here, Marco, is one of the first things in looking at all these different popular social media platforms. I know TikTok is trending in the headlines right now, but we really have to look at all of social media. And what they found was that most social media apps collect a lot of data, and that data is essential for its overall functionality. So it's not even just I'm collecting data and then I'm going to hand it off to Procter & Gamble and they're going to send you a coupon for toothpaste. It's actually things like GPS location and personal details, such as tracking your device ID, which a lot of people may not realize. It's almost like your passport number or your social security number to your phone. So it does uniquely identify your phone, your tablet, your laptop, uniquely to you as the buyer. And then once they track you, they don't just track you on the platform that you happen to be logged in at, but they look at where you came from and what tabs you had open and where you went to next. And they do have the ability to track that, to store that. Now, you may ask yourself, well, what's important to you and me? And so what I love about the basis of their research is they basically said, okay, there's a lot of Apple users out there, you know, a lot of people with iPhones. So they went to Apple's privacy policy and they benchmarked all of these apps against Apple's privacy policy that maybe you've read it, maybe you haven't. I think other than lawyers, I might be the only non-lawyer that reads privacy policies. But they actually ranked these apps against the policies. They found that the most data-intensive apps out there are shopping and food delivery apps. They collect, if there's like 32 possible data points based on kind of the Apple privacy policy, they collect on average 21. So I guess they need to know when you're going to be hungry, Marco, so they can anticipate sending you like a little ad, like it's time for you to get a little snack and I can just deliver it for you. What's really, really interesting was that DoorDash has significant data and collection, data collection and tracking practices out of kind of all of the different types of apps that are out there. I'm not picking on them. They just happen to notice. And you know, sometimes when somebody uses more trackers than others, they might just be really good at it and really good at anticipating what you're going to need next. I know we talk a lot about TikTok, but the study also found that two Meta companies, Facebook and Instagram, are actually considered the most privacy invasive apps when you rank them against the Apple privacy policy. Following in sort of close third is TikTok. So those are things that we all need to be thinking about, whether you actually say, I'm on these apps, I'm not on these apps, no, I deleted the app, I don't use the app. Just be thinking about what are some things that you can do, whether you are an active user, not a user at all, an inactive user, to keep your data safe and secure, and also have the opportunity from a privacy perspective, opt in and opt out wherever possible.
So let's stay a little bit on this overview and the way that people may think about it, right? So when we talk about cybersecurity, most time we have to get to the point where, well, it is between convenience and security, mm-hmm. right? So we say that a lot in the industry, but people, maybe the regular user, doesn't think it that way because they mostly want the convenience. So yeah, you wanted to get the deal when it's dinner time, wherever you are, they know where you are, and the deal on travel, the deal on the entertainment, and you like to scroll off that Instagram with all the video that magically you like them all, because guess what? They know what you like, right? Mm-hmm. So why do you think the perception of the user, it doesn't really get into the safety, the security, and the privacy? It's all about the convenience. Any thought on that?
Well, these apps are not really pitched that way.
They don't tell you. Right?
They don't tell you. So that, you know, they don't say up front, really truly say up front, this is going to be an incredible productivity gain for you. But in return, because you get to use this app for free, I'm going to require some of your data to be able to make it free for you to use. And that's, I think, the biggest takeaway, I think, for many people is if the product is free, mm-hmm. how do they make revenue? You have to be the product that is for sale. So that's kind of the little hidden agreement behind the scenes, which is you are the product. And by opting in and using the platform, you need to know you're the one who's for sale. You know, Marco, I often tell people when you're clicking through that privacy policy that's in about a 4-point font, but you can't use the app until you click, yes, I agree. You're often opting into a level of privacy that you're giving up. So privacy policies typically spell out the lack of privacy you have when you use the app.
It's kind of funny. It's a privacy policy against your privacy mostly. It's more to legally protect the app they're going to use.
Think about it as a disclaimer and disclosure. That's yeah. what I'm like, I know we call it a privacy policy, but really, is that really what it is? Because a privacy policy, in my mind, should read something like this. We believe everybody has a right, an individual right, to privacy, safety, and security. And because of that, we're going to give you an opportunity to opt in and opt out of certain features. Please understand that if you put your privacy settings very high, some of the features and functionality and conveniences may not be available to you. But because we respect your individual right to privacy, safety, and security, we want to make these features available to you. That, to me, would be the language for a privacy policy. Mm-hmm. That's not how they read. I mean, tell me, Marco, have you found a privacy policy that sounds like that?
No. And also, I'm a big fan of opt out by default, not opt in by default. And you shouldn't buy a new TV if we go in the IoT or any other app that you download and that you need to go and opt out if you want to. Like, I'm not going to name the insurance company that I use for my car, but they specifically say that if you don't want us to sell your information to advertisers, you need to go log in to your account and opt out. So, well, at least they let me know, right? Now, let's talk about the TikTok case, because from this research, TikTok is not even the worst. The worst is actually, you know, owned by the same company, Instagram and Facebook. But that's apparently okay. I mean, yeah, sure, they've been going on Congress and talk about privacy and the GDPR, European community, blah, blah, blah. But lately, this TikTok, I mean, what's the politics behind that?
Well, I mean, there is something to be said when you think about a technology company. And we're talking about social media apps, but you, Marco, you brought up a great point, which is our Internet of Things, any smart devices, smart buildings. And oh, by the way, our cars, most cars built within the last 10, 15 years are really just computers on wheels, and we just get the opportunity to ride in them, right, at this point. So technology is so ubiquitous. I think, you know, one of the things we have to think through here is what are we trying to accomplish with the recent bill that was passed? So let's unpack TikTok a little bit here. Mm-hmm. A lot of people may not realize, but in the United States alone, we have over 170 million Americans who use TikTok. We have over 7 million small businesses in America who that's how they actually reach their customers. It is an incredible platform for a lot of people. Now, that's not to say that they don't have a responsibility to look at the addictive qualities, to do better as it relates to some of the mental health issues that have been traced back to the platform. All of the social media platforms have some issues. But when you look at TikTok, some of the concerns come from the origin story. So the origin story, different from Meta, which is headquartered in the United States, the origin story is it was born out of ByteDance, which is a headquartered company in China. I'm not a politician. I was a political appointee. So I don't want this to be taken as sort of a political opinion, because it's not. But I think the best way I would describe our current relationship with China would be frosty, maybe ice cold, but it's fairly frosty right now. And there are proven legitimate concerns in other parts of technology ecosystem where there were concerns that data could have or did get sent somehow surreptitiously to China from American businesses, American people. So the bill that was passed, I want people to understand, because I know in the media it's often talked about as the TikTok ban, but the bill that was passed is not called the TikTok ban bill. It's called Protecting Americans from Foreign Adversary Controlled Applications. There is a precedent for analyzing technology that has an origin story that is not the United States. And so there's a process. You have to apply if you want United States businesses or individuals to use it. There are frameworks you're supposed to follow. You could be subject to both planned and surprise on-site inspections, where both from a physical security perspective, but also a cybersecurity perspective, you might have to follow an inspection. This bill still has not cleared to be signed fully into law, but as of you and I talking right now, Marco, however, assuming it is going to be fully passed into law, TikTok is first in line to be considered under this particular bill. We do have precedent, though, with other companies. So, for example, people may recall China's Huawei Technologies and ZTE, who both kind of got sideways with the U.S. government, and they were rated as posing an unacceptable risk to U.S. national security. But banning an app versus a technology is fairly unprecedented in American history. We do know that there was a short period of time where there were bans on TikTok in other countries, but that was fairly on. And so it'll be interesting to see, once this is enacted, will ByteDance agree to a sale? That remains to be seen. So they'll be given a short period of time to divest themselves. Who has the money? Does ByteDance? Like, I mean, I have so many more questions than I have answers. But let's just say the clock runs out and they don't decide to sell or they don't find a buyer. I don't know if all technology platforms have done their scenario planning here. So one, there will be an impact on small business. No, there's no doubt in my mind, there will be an impact on those small businesses that use it to reach their customers. There will be an impact emotionally for a lot of people who count on it for, you know, rolling pandas, for example. I mean, who doesn't love a rolling panda? And I don't even have a TikTok account, but because I did some research on TikTok, looked at rolling pandas on their website without an account, I now have rolling pandas in my feed constantly. And I have to say, I really adore it and it really makes my day. So I've got so many questions around have the app stores all done scenario-based planning to say, worst case, I might be told not to just remove it from the store. What if I'm told I have to search for it on phones and delete it? I mean, we don't know where this is going to go. This is unprecedented, right? And so I have another question. All of you internet services providers in America, are you going to have to block traffic to TikTok? And have you playbooked that? And then all social media platforms. If I'm a user on Instagram in Germany, and I love this TikTok video of rolling pandas, and I cross-post the TikTok video onto Instagram from Germany, and my pals in the United States see it on Instagram, is that a violation of the ban? I don't know. Marco, these are questions I have. Do you have answers for me? I just changed the interview process. I'm interviewing
That's cool.
you now.
Yeah. All right. No, first of all, I love when we create more questions than answers, because that makes people think. And I think that, as you're clearly outlining here, there's not an easy solution. You know, when you can call it ban, but what does it mean, right? I mean, you just outlined few of the things that may be consequential to this, and how I think for the nature of the internet, you can't really wall it. I mean, we will become what we don't want to be, in a way, right? So, and I have issues sometimes, even when I go to Europe and I look at the GDPR and how, you know, I got pop things. It doesn't matter if I'm a European, American, or another country, it's because where you are and how things are different, but it's not a clear cut. And I think that's the thing. So my question back to you is, wouldn't it be a better way to handle situation like this? Because as a user, now, as a government, I may see, you know, okay, it's an adversary, it's a little frozen relationship, as you mentioned. But as a user, if the company that got a lot of stuff from me and affect my life and knows what I do, what I don't do, and things that maybe I don't want to share if I knew that I was going to share it, does it really make a difference? Is it based in the United States or in the UK or in Italy or in China as a user? And I think that's why the users are coming out, and, you know, the influencers and the people that create content there, like, what, can't do that, can't ban it. So maybe a redefinition of privacy here, a redefinition of how we handle these things, and you can't just build a wall.
Yeah, we would be better served globally. All citizens would be better served if countries would really truly enact a individual privacy bill of rights and have that bill of rights be in plain, easy to understand consumer language, have a place for arbitration when you find issues with your data, have the opportunity, if you're going to monetize data in a way where it's easily linked back to me and my digital footprints, then I'd like a piece of that action. Why can't, if you're going to make 50 cents off me in that moment, I would like 25 cents or 49 cents of that, you know, whatever it is. So businesses do need the ability to collect and monetize information that they collect as part of their operations. There are good reasons for doing that. However, there should be a win-win in that data collection. So, for example, I came from financial services. Marco, I don't think you would appreciate it if I had said to you, you know, now that you've opened up a deposit account, I'm going to have a banker follow you around. And every time they notice an event in your life, they're going to tap you on the shoulder and give you an application for the next banking product. You would find that pretty creepy if we had somebody following you around. However, I can tell you, even in the days before social media, we had predictive models that would say, Marco just bought a house. It's kind of this size. He doesn't have kids yet, but it's kind of interesting to us. And so based on demographics, based on other customers we have that are a lot like Marco, he might need a new car soon. And why don't we let Marco know that we really value and treasure him? And let's beat the other banks to the chase and offer him the absolute best financing possible, because we love Marco. And we just have a feeling now that he bought a house, he might need to upgrade his car. We may find that you open up a custodial savings account and the child's about 5 years old at some point. And in banking, we would have models to say, guess what? Kids typically go to driving school at age 15. Typically, parents want to upgrade a car and give the used car to the kid. Let's offer that. So there's all these different patterns of life and behaviors where if you're just doing good customer service and customer experience, you want to be able to look at that data and model it in a way that is not obtrusive, that is not creepy, but does give you conveniences and does offer you things during these different milestones of your life. But fast forward to the data aggregation we have going on today. If I was taking your data as a banker and selling it to a third party, even if I anonymized you, I had to disclose that to you, Marco, and you got to look at it and opt in and opt out of those third-party marketing services. Now, based on how data collection works in the digital space for social media, they're not regulated like the banks are. So we need to do something different. And it's not about hitting each company on the head and saying, shame on you. Why don't we set the guardrails at the consumer level, just like we've done for protecting consumer credit cards, just like we've done in other areas of our lives. And we're past due, but you know what? We can get caught up here. And it really needs to happen globally. And then we have a duty of care standard that all big tech social media platforms know they must follow.
Yeah, a few things that I like here. It's the fact that you're referring to the pre-internet age and how marketing, advertising, politician group research, they go and decide, where am I going campaign next year? But how, you know, how do I address this target audience, this social demographic, and so on? And coupon in the supermarket, at least you get a discount there, but the amount of information that you're giving on the things that you buy, you're giving away everything about your life. If you buy a medicine, if you buy a certain product or another. And this has been going on for the longest coupon time, right? So, but the dimension now, it's a little bit different, I guess. And I want to ask you one last question, which is, you mentioned the guardrail, and we hear that a lot, like AI act, the guardrail, the people that want to just don't have the AI in the highway at all, people that want to not have guardrail at all. But maybe I think the guardrail is a good concept, meaning just put the limit and the safety, but let people drive through, right? So are we finding ourselves in the same situation with everything at this point that is online, from generative AI to all the new connected technology, the car? I did an episode about the information that the car gets about you. It was in Mozilla research, like a few months ago. They even know your sexual orientation. What does it mean that we're driving a car, right? So is guardrail a good model for you, in your opinion?
Yeah, I think having that discussion around guardrails is very good, because they're going to change over time. You know, as technology becomes enhanced and there's new innovations that we don't know about today, having those guardrails, having laws on the books that are flexible, that focus on guardrails, because if we just focus squarely on one technology, what's hot today is not going to be what's hot tomorrow. You know, you can ask a platform like MySpace how things are going right now, right? And so if we had done all of our laws about concerns about MySpace, we'd be overcome by events. Mm-hmm. And so I think we need to focus more on, regardless of a company's origin story, what country they're in, what are the guardrails that we all should follow? And those need to be the standard duty of care. If you want to do business on the internet, if you want to collect data, if you want to sell data, if you want to be a business, you just have to follow these rules. Mm-hmm. And if we start to do that country by country, then social media, big tech, devices, cars, you know, everything that's got technology built in will have to follow that duty of care. And I know that this can be done because we have a framework and a construct for it in the physical world. So mm-hmm. for example, I don't feel great if I get into an elevator and I don't see a certificate in there, or it's like 5 years old. I'm like, okay, I think I'll take the stairs. Thank you very much. and that's like an international standard. You typically see a certificate of the last inspection in an elevator. Mm-hmm. So we have a construct for doing this of saying, you know, here's the duty of care if you're going to be in a certain type of business. Here's an inspection and here's a certification. You can still, you know, have challenges, but at least there's a minimum set of guardrails around safety, resiliency, reliability. And we're really lacking that. Most things today are a recommendation and a suggestion. Maybe it gets found out if you're in a heavily regulated industry, it gets found out during an audit. But social media, other than a few guardrails around, are you taking payment data? What are you doing with somebody's profile? You shouldn't be storing people's social security numbers or things like that in the clear. It should be encrypted. But other than those basics, it is still very much kind of a wild, wild west as it relates to data. And even when our social media companies tell us, Marco, that, well, I'm not sending data that says it's Marco. Like it's anonymized. I've removed his name. That's actually not enough anymore. Based on the computing processing power that we have, and big data analytics and incredible algorithms, we can correlate with great correlation and accuracy and get it down. Ted and I wrote about this in our book, Privacy in the Age of Big Data. He's a brilliant lawyer. And we saw the research studies say that you could take anonymized data from a social media platform, purchase data from a couple different third-party marketing brokers, correlate the data, overlay what we believe your current zip code to be, and within down to about 35 people, guess if it's you, Marco, or somebody else. That's pretty close to not being anonymized, if you agree, to say it's either Marco or 34 other people in his neighborhood. So you're starting to get where even if the data is anonymized one place and sent somewhere else, the aggregation portion de-anonymizes you pretty quickly.
Yep. And you just jump into George Orwell.
Well, and if we have another moment, Marco, I do want to give people hope because there are some things, you know, So Marco, while we're waiting for Superman and while we're waiting for these privacy bill of rights and guardrails, there are some incredible, mostly free tools that people should just try it out and just think about using them. So for example, I love browsers that were built with privacy in mind first versus privacy bolted on later. For example, privacy browser Brave. Oh my gosh, it's one of my favorites. So Brave, Brave. And you can actually turn it so tightly towards privacy, you will see websites break before your eyes. Mm-hmm. So you can set all of your different privacy settings, and then it'll let you know if there's a favorite website that you use that literally will not function. You can let just that website have just enough functionality to work. And it tells you while you're sitting there, we've blocked this many trackers, and you'll be surprised how many different places you visit and the trackers that are on there. So Brave can be a great way to grab some of your privacy back. Think about having more than one email account. So the email account perhaps that you're using for, you know, maybe conversations with the family, or you don't really want it tied to marketing. Maybe it's between you and your family CPA or your doctor or whatever it is. Proton Mail can be a great way to sort of firewall off your life with a free product. So be thinking about these different ways. Another one is don't always give your real cell phone out, especially if you're just trying to get coupons and things like that. Get a burner number for example, Google Voice, Talkatone. You can get a free burner number. You can still forward it to your actual cell phone, but that can be a way to, again, just kind of create some different privacy barriers for yourself. Reading privacy policies isn't always practical for everybody, but when you get an opportunity, definitely take a look. Mozilla does great research on the lack of privacies you have on a lot of platforms. And Canada does a lot of great research reports across different technologies and where you may be uncomfortable about the privacy settings for those technologies. So there are just a few things that everybody can do. They're not super technically complicated. They don't cost a lot of money. And it can be something very easily integrated to how you already live your life online.
Yep. Great advice. Great advice for sure. And I think some company, just to go to the free market, they are actually embracing this. Like, you know, what Proton Mail is doing, you know, Apple, if you have an Apple ID, they suggest you to use a different email, hide my email. It's a really, really good thing, as you said. And it may not be the solution to the internet and the manipulation that of our, you know, desires and what advertising has been doing for many, many years anyway. And But I think we need to empower ourselves a little bit. I think that's the message too. It's not our job to be cybersecurity people, but it is our job to, you know, before you buy a product, to read the ingredient maybe and the label, and that comes with the security as well. So a lot we could talk about more, but we're gonna end it here. I want to thank you for these. I think it's been very helpful to understand the whole TikTok ban situation, or what we can do to get a better privacy, or maybe how the world should look at these things moving forward and redefine what we need as technology expand and grow and change so quickly that it sometimes give you vertigo, right? Like, what's new today? What am I going to talk about today? So with that in mind, I know that you're coming out with the second edition of your book, which you presented years ago on my show, Manipulated. And I would love for you to come back and talk about that. And that's an all more psychological approach to all of this. So, Theresa, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on. And I'd love to come back and talk to you about Manipulated. It is available for pre-order right now on Amazon for anybody who's interested in really unpacks what is happening across, not, and social media is not to blame. Really, I like to describe it as the misuse of technology by people with ulterior motives. And so kind of help people think about how to spot and stop these manipulation campaigns.
Very good. Very important tool in our arsenal, for sure. And for everybody else, stay tuned, subscribe, and there'll be many more interesting conversations coming up, and hopefully we'll make you think. So stay tuned. Thank you again, Theresa. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks, everybody. Thank you, Marco.
Bye.
Black Cloak provides concierge cybersecurity protection to corporate executives and high net worth individuals to protect against hacking, reputational loss, financial loss, and the impacts of a corporate data breach. Learn more at blackcloak.io.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Redefining Society podcast, hosted by Marco Ciappelli. If you learned something new and this conversation made you think, then take a moment to rate this show and add it to your favorite podcast player. subscribe to our YouTube channel, and share this episode with your friends, family, and colleagues. We invite you to come back for more stories and follow Marco Cappelli on his social media as he continues this journey into the future of our societies.
Insights, solutions, and networking all come together at RSA Conference. Join a global cybersecurity community at rsaconference.com/ITSP Mag 24.